Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We live in Lyndon Johnson's America. So says Joseph Califano, the president's top domestic advisor. And he backs it up with a long list of groundbreaking legislation that includes Medicare, Medicaid, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and did I mention Head Start, food stamps, the school breakfast program, and the Fair Housing Act of 1968? Joe Califano had a bird's-eye view to the way this most fascinating man worked and used power, and he tells all in a reissued version of his 1991 book, The Triumph and Tragedy of Lyndon Johnson, The White House Years. Joe Califano will be in town Wednesday evening to speak at the Kansas City Public Library, and he joins us right now from NPR Studios in New York. And Joe Califano, what a pleasure to have you. Welcome to the show.
Well, it's great to be on your show, Steve.
Almost exactly 50 years ago today, Joe, we're off by 4 days here. You were at Johnson's Ranch in the Texas Hill Country, and you were spending the day with him. You had just been named to the White House senior staff. You hardly knew the president. And at one moment on this first day, he suddenly stops, drops his trousers, and he's grabbing his right cheek and saying to you that something hurts back there and wondering if he has a boil. Explain this to me. The president of the United States would do this to a new aide. Why?
I have no idea why. I mean, I think it was part of
he's sizing you up,
Johnson.
Joe.
Yeah. Everything hung out. He did other things that day. As you know, you obviously read the book.
Yes.
I mean, when I arrived at the ranch, he was in the pool. And, when I landed, Lady Bird Johnson met me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know the president. I'd shaken his hand once and been at one event. And Lady Bird said, you want some breakfast? And I said, no. And she said, you better eat something, because with Lyndon, you never know the next time you're going to eat. So I went into the pool. He was in the pool. He waved me into the pool, took me to an end of the pool where he's 6'3", I'm 5'10", he's standing on the bottom, I'm treading water. And he starts talking. He says, you know, the transportation system of this country is a mess. We got to put all the agencies in a Department of Transportation. And he hit me on the shoulder. He said, now we've got to do that. And then he said, and we got to prove that we can rebuild cities. We need a program that will show we can do something about these ghettos and rebuild cities. Pushes me with that. And then he says, and whether anybody is black, yellow, green, purple, red, with every color pushing me down in the water, We need a housing act that says they can live wherever they want. Now, can you do that? And I said, oh, my God, yes, Mr. President. I have no idea how. That's how it started. And it was that way all through the 3.5 years I was there.
Well, later on,
now, there were other moments.
Yeah, but later on that day, he takes you water skiing, Joe, and I got the impression he was testing you again. What happened then?
Well, it was just, we go, you know, he had a boat, and then he had a small bullet boat, like that boat we've seen pictures of that George Bush used to drive around Kennebunkport, waters in. And I'm water skiing, and he's on that boat, and he's going fast as hell and swinging back and forth. And he threw me, and I went off. We were going so fast that when I landed in the water, I felt like I was split, and my rump was going to split in half. And then... I got up and I said, I'll be damned, I'm going to stay on these skis. And I did stay on them. And then next morning, this is the other side of Lyndon Johnson. Next morning, he used to get a white Ford convertible, not a Lincoln convertible, from Henry Ford every year.
Mm-hmm.
And we're driving. He's driving the car. I'm in the seat next to him. And there's a guy on the road. And he looks like he's sort of a drunk, and he's red-faced, and he's ragged, and just kind of lying there. And the president turns to me. He puts his thumb and forefinger almost touching each other, right next to each other, and he says to me, as long as you work for me, you never forget that the difference between him and you and him and me is that much.
Huh. That's interesting. And when he would drive along around the ranch, he would sometimes sort of hang out his left hand with a cup in it and expect the Secret Service agents to run up and fill his cup with scotch and water or whatever it was he was drinking.
He'd shake the cup out, and they'd expect him to come up. They'd take the cup, they'd put some more ice in it, they'd put some scotch in it and some soda, and they'd run up and put it in his hand again. That's right. Although it's interesting, he did, in December of 65, he stopped drinking. He may have had one or two drinks for the next 3 years, but he stopped drinking because he was so concerned that something would be happening in Vietnam, and he would have had a couple of drinks, and he didn't want that to happen. Hmm. Even though there are many occasions when Lady Bird, his doctors were saying, you know, take a drink at night, just relax a little bit. He didn't do it.
Former LBJ aide Joseph Califano is my guest. This is a man you describe as infernally complex, driven, and driving, and he drove you hard, Joe. How frustrating was it working for Lyndon Baines Johnson?
Well, you know, it was frustrating and exhilarating. I mean, you could never do anything fast enough. I mean, he'd say, one of his great expressions was, you do it today, now, not tomorrow, not tonight, not later this afternoon, now. And that was one part. The other part was, you know, somebody said to me when I went to work for him, it was absolutely right, you're never as good as he says you are when he praises you, and you're never as bad as you are when he chews you out. And to give you an example, we had I did come up with a program to rebuild urban ghettos, and the idea was you'd have the health, the police, you'd get businesses in there, you'd do housing at the same time, you'd do sanitation, all of it. And I called it the Demonstration Cities Bill. Well, when the bill was working its way through Congress, we had these demonstrations and riots in many American cities. And the Republicans used that title and just banged him over the head with it. And he started calling it the Model Cities Bill. And when we finally got it passed, and he signed it in the East Room, and he and I are walking back to his office, and he says, "Now you get this into your head. You damn well think about how you title these bills in the future. And from now on, I don't want anybody in the government to call this anything except the Model Cities Bill." Huh. And we did. Huh. And that's what it became known as.
Yeah. You know, your thesis in this book is simple. You write that we all live in Lyndon Johnson's America. And that means what, Joe?
Well, it means, if you just stop and think about this, you mentioned a few of them. I mean, you mentioned Head Start. That's, you know, we talk about preschool education. There are a million kids in Head Start. The not just elementary and secondary education, but the Higher Education Act, the loans, the grants, which are called Pell Grants now, but because of the most recent authorization, but was centered by that name, the work study program. 60% of the kids in college are on those programs, And then we have bilingual education. We have bilingual education in 70 languages in our country now. And in health, Medicare, about 60 million people on Medicare, 70 million on Medicaid. And two-thirds of the nursing home care in this country is paid for by federal programs. We got 9,000 community health centers all over the country. And, you know, one of the laws that people tend to overlook but is very important was immigration reform. We had a bill called the National Origins Quota Act that was in effect when Johnson became president, which by and large limited immigration to Northern Europe and the British Isles. Johnson changed that, ended the quotas for the rest of the world, and to give you a sense of the, you know, and open us up to Latin America, Mexico, Southern Europe, the Asia, Africa, and today, when he signed that bill, 85% of the immigrants to this country were from Northern Europe and the British Isles. Today, 85% of the immigrants to this country are from the Asia, Africa, Latin America, Southern Europe, the Eastern Europe, and only 15% from those. In civil rights, you know, we know the Act of 64 banning discrimination accommodations and employment. the Voting Rights Act, which is still controversial to this day, which opened up voting to African Americans in the South, and the environment. You know, Johnson, clean air, clean water, solid waste disposal, motor vehicle pollution, all of those bills, highway beautification, were all passed while he was president. And he was, think about this, Steve, I'm quoting now something he said in February of 1965 about the environment. Mm-hmm. Air pollution is no longer confined to isolated places. This generation has altered the composition of the atmosphere on a global scale through radioactive materials and a steady increase in carbon monoxide from the burning of fossil fuels. Now, think about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he sounds like the Environmental National Resources Defense Fund or the Pope today on this subject. And then in the arts, the Kennedy Center, the Hirshhorn Museum of Sculpture, the Renwick Gallery, American Film Institute, all of that, and the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities, which have spawned 800 symphony orchestras and hundreds of dance companies and chamber groups and opera companies. And here we are in NPR. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting was one of the great society laws. Wow. And today, what, we have 900 public radio stations, about 350 public TV, and a Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah.
It's hard to... So we are living in his world. And lastly, I mean, virtually every product, the way products are marketed and packaged and all that fine print came from his consumer laws. One of the things we tend to forget, Johnson's presidency spanned the time when the country was morphing from corner grocers and local pharmacists and the local bank and the small retailer into the big supermarkets and the national drug chains and the big banks department stores. And that led to, you know, truth in lending, truth in packaging, product safety, highway and auto safety, wholesome meat and poultry and fish. And, you know, remember the Child Safety Act. I don't know if once he tried to get me one day. He said, what is it like to work for him? When he couldn't get you, it was just infuriating to him. And he ran me down in a hospital in Washington because my two-year-old son, Joe, had swallowed a bottle of aspirin, and they were pumping his stomach out.
Mm.
And he finally gets me there, and he says, what the hell are you doing there? I said, Mr. President, what the hell are you doing there? Your president needs you here. And I said, Mr. President, my son Joe swallowed this, got into this aspirin bottle. And he said, those damn bottles, he said, they've got to make those pill containers so that no kid can open them. And that's why you and I and anybody else has so much trouble opening our pill boxes when we get them from the drugstore.
Yeah. So even those kinds of incidents would result in him thinking about legislation to make the world a better place.
Yeah, it was constant. It was just constant. And, you know, and he'd see something. I went up once to Brooklyn where I grew up in the neighborhood, which is now shifted from being largely Italians and Jews. By the time I went up there in 66, it was all African Americans, and there was one little store, a little candy store, with two Jewish brothers running it. I'll never forget it. They were, you know, knew me and from all my childhood. And I came back and I said to the president, you know, I said to them, why didn't you, you know, so they were scared to death and they weren't doing very good. I said, why didn't you move? And they said, well, we have no money. The property's not worth anything. And the president said, we ought to have the Small Business Administration help people in situations like that. Hmm. And we got them to do it and issue regulations. It was constant.
Well, you point out, and Joe, that most presidents these days, you have some great context here. They're deemed successful if they pass, you know, a few major bills over the course of their terms. You point to welfare reform for President Clinton, No Child Left Behind for President George W. Bush, the Affordable Care Act for President Obama. But Johnson, as you're pointing out, passed hundreds of legislative initiatives. Do I have that right? I mean, that context is so important.
It is. It's true. He did. That is the context. He did. He changed this country dramatically. And remember, think about how hard change is. I mean, that was, you know, his ability to do that, and also to do it at the time he's got this awful, unpopular war in Vietnam. I mean, he never lost, you know, as he used to say, this was the war he loved, not that bitch of a war in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, it wasn't just laws, although he had a terrific ability to persuade people. I mean, there are lots of examples. Maybe one would be, you know, elementary and secondary education was really tough. Nobody had been able to pass federal aid to elementary and secondary schools because the Catholics were able to kill it if they didn't get aid to parochial schools, and the secular community, the secular urban Jews and the evangelicals were able to kill it if it did have aid to parochial schools. And it was further complicated because of his focus on civil rights. And the chair of the House Education Committee was black, Adam Clayton Powell. And Johnson said to Powell, Adam, you got to get out of town. You got to sign this bill to somebody else. That's one thing we've got to do if we're going to get it passed. And Powell did go. Those of us who remember politics in those years, he went to Bimini. And that trip never returned to New York, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But Johnson got Cardinal Spellman, the New York Cardinal. He got Billy Graham, the great evangelical preacher, and Arthur Goldberg, and he had them standing, fully dressed, by the side of the White House pool. That room is the hottest room in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And he started, and because he had an idea. Governor Hugh Carey, who was then a congressman from Brooklyn, who now took over the bill, had come up with the idea of leasing secular books and equipment to Catholic schools. And he was trying to sell this to them, and he let them sweat. I mean, Cardinal Spellman was sweating so much, all the way through his black cassock, you could see it.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, he got them to agree. And then the bill got passed, and he asked the Speaker of the House, John McCormick, to hold up sending it to the White House because he wanted to sign it on Hugh Carey's birthday to thank him. For coming up with that bill, and he did.
So he would do anything it took, Joe, to get something like this passed, including making Spellman wait until he sweat so much any resistance he had was out the window.
That's exactly right. And you know, remember, we had the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden.
Yeah, you talk about it in the book, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Joe Hirshhorn was a Latvian Jew, had this fantastic sculpture collection. And art. Lady Bird saw it in Connecticut and came back and she said, Lyndon, we've got to have this. He's willing to give this to the government to have a museum. He wants the museum named after him. And we proposed the Hirshhorn Museum. And Claiborne Pell, a senator from Rhode Island, of the Pelham Pells, was opposed to naming it Hirshhorn Museum, wanted to call the Smithsonian Museum. And we couldn't move him. I went up to see him. Other aides went up to see him. Finally, the president said, let's get him down here. And he comes down to the little green office next to the White House. And Johnson starts pitching this. And Claiborne tells it, it should be named the Smithsonian. And Johnson said, you know, Claiborne, I want this American people to see this art. And the only way they're going to see it is if we name it after this guy. He said, I don't care if it's called the Horseshit Museum. I want the American people to see it. And Pell was absolutely flabbergasted at that. left the White House, still hadn't agreed, called a couple of days later, had really understood the extent to which LBJ was going to embarrass him, and he said, okay, I'll go along with it. Huh. And we got the sculpture.
But you already mentioned Vietnam, Joe. It took away so much luster from this president's achievements. And a lot of folks would say, you know, that was justified. It should have done that. How do you square the two? How did this man do such great work domestically and yet get so bogged down in such an unpopular war?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, every advisor recommended it to him. Everyone in the government, except George Ball, who was the Undersecretary of State, and Clark Clifford, who was the most vehement opponent of building up American presence in Vietnam. He sent people out there to look and look, and listen to the records of the phone conversations, and you hear how he said there's no way to win this, and he and senators like Dick Russell. Finally, he builds it up, and then he kept saying, trying to get him to the negotiating table. He couldn't get him to the negotiating table. Then in 1968. McNamara leaves the Pentagon, and McNamara said after that he never knew whether he was fired or resigned.
Mm-hmm.
Many people experienced that under Lyndon Johnson. And then he appoints Clark Clifford Secretary of Defense, the guy he knows is totally opposed to our being involved there. And then he pulls out of the race in March of 68. He wanted to end it on his watch. The Vietnamese finally do go to the negotiating table in Paris. They are negotiating. Johnson's getting close to a deal. The Russians invade Czechoslovakia, which was a setback, but he's still getting close. But the South Vietnamese won't agree, and we now know, we knew then, but we now know in great detail, that Anna Chenault, on behalf of Richard Nixon, was telling the South Vietnamese, don't make a deal with Johnson. You'll mm-hmm. get a much better deal with President Nixon. Mm-hmm. And those are the National Security Agency tapes that reflect that. And he was not able to end it. And it's tragic because that war went on for another four more years. Another 20 plus thousand American boys were killed.
But I was going to say, Joe, in 1968, when you're talking about this, he's already 5 years in.
Yeah, he was 5 years in. We're already 5 years. And incidentally, people have to remember the settlement that Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger finally got was essentially the settlement Johnson was trying to sell to the South Vietnamese in 1968. Why didn't he just say no at the beginning? I don't think any of us know. I think we all know. Remember, the Democratic Party was looking over its right shoulder all the time because Barry Goldwater,
mm-hmm.
the presence of the conservative right, the Republicans. Remember, John Kennedy went to Texas because of a fear that he wouldn't be able to carry Texas even with Lyndon Johnson if he didn't do something about it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a tragedy. That's the tragedy in my book, the triumphant mm-hmm. tragedy of Lyndon Johnson. The tragedies of the Vietnam War. The triumph is how much better he and more just he made this country.
In writing about your book, the Wall Street Journal questioned LBJ's legacy, pointing out the cost of the Great Society, trillions of dollars, and that his war on poverty led to massive welfare dependency that only grows today. At least the Wall Street Journal talks about this. What about that part of it, Joe?
Okay, I think there are a couple of very important things here. One, the Great Society was aimed at providing a hand up, not a hand out. The welfare program was passed by Franklin Roosevelt. It was part of the New Deal. We tried to make one major change in that program. Lyndon Johnson proposed that there was a rule that the man had to leave the house. If there was a man in the house, the wife, the mother, and the child could not get welfare payments. So we basically continued to contribute to the breakup of the African-American family. We tried to get that provision repealed and eliminated. And what we ran into were congressmen, these were Democrats, Wilbur Mills and others, Russell Long saying, no, these welfare women have all these babies. We're not going to do that. It'll just be more, and it's just to put another guy on. And the other thing we tried to do was provide education for those women and child care for their children so they could get some vocational training.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get that passed. The law, if you look at the Great Society, it was all about, it was really two things. It was a hand up for let me go back. It was first the economy. Johnson spent more time on the economy than on the war in Vietnam or anything else. And the economy boomed during those years. And he used to, that would take care of 75% of the American people. And it did. Then you had those who, if they got some health care or they got vocational education, or they and if they got the talents, they wouldn't be discriminated against. They could get jobs and stand on their own 2 feet. Mm-hmm. And that was the bulk of all those programs. And incidentally, even with Reagan's complaint about the poverty, all those poverty programs except for one are still in place today. Mm-hmm. The other group of people were the old and the, you know, permanently disabled. And for them, these were sort of people who needed either money or the things that money could buy. And that's Medicare. That's the nursing home coverage. That's the increase in Social Security. We greatly increased Social Security benefits mm-hmm. to put money in those hands. And what happened? I mean, poverty was about 35% for the elderly Americans when Johnson was president. It's about 9% today because of those programs, among the old. Mm-hmm. Poverty did go down. Now, sure, did he want to redistribute wealth? Absolutely, although he passed in 64 the tax cut that took the highest rate down from 90 to 70%. I think that's not a fair criticism by the Journal.
Joseph Califano's new book, The Triumph and Tragedy of Lyndon Johnson. He'll be speaking at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library on Wednesday evening. More information to grab a seat, go to kclibrary.org. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk with Joe about how he came to take a job with Lyndon Johnson to begin with. He came into politics as a John F. Kennedy man. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation with psychologist Wes Crenshaw about young adults transitioning to life on their own, you can find that at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll have 5 questions for legendary singer Patti LaBelle, and we'll look at the pioneers of meteorology and find out what the heck is going on with all this crazy weather out here this year. Well, for this segment, we're visiting with Joseph Califano, the longtime aide to President Lyndon Johnson. He has a new and reissued version of his 1991 book, The Triumph and Tragedy of Lyndon Johnson, The White House Years. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Joe, I was really struck. You tell a great story in the book about how you came to work for Lyndon Johnson to begin with. And it's a move that just totally reshaped your career. And there was a lot of luck in the fact that you wound up working for Johnson because you were such a devoted Kennedy man. How did you wind up working for LBJ?
Well, you know, I came to Washington. I read James McGregor Burns' biography of John Kennedy, and it's kind of turned me on. And then I ultimately got a job in the Pentagon, working for Cyrus Vance, who was then general counsel, as his assistant, and then he became Secretary of the Army, and I went with him. He made me general counsel of the Army. Then I went to work as Robert McNamara's top aide. And part of that job was to service the White House. McNamara was a very good bureaucrat, so all the requests from the White House had to come through me, and I got to know the people on his staff. And the first time he called me, the first time I got called was the day after the landslide in 1964, and Bill Moyers, Mac Bundy actually said, you know, we want you to come over here and be on the White House staff. You'll work on Latin American problems and help us recruit people. And I came back and I told McNamara, he said, out of the question. He said, only 2 jobs on McNamara's staff, only 2 jobs on Lyndon Johnson's staff that are worth it. One is Bundy's job, the National Security Advisor, and the other would be if he'd create a domestic advisor. And that's it. He said, I'll take care of it. And that was it. Then it ended. And then Bob said, well, I'm afraid we may have just whet his appetite. And then a few months later, when Moyers became press secretary, Jack Valeni called me and said, the president wants you to join his staff. I said, I have to talk to McNamara. Valeni said, the president already has. You're going to be the domestic advisor. So I, and that involved And then they said to me, you know, this will involve handling his legislative program, proposing it, and any domestic crises or problems. Went back and reported that to McNamara. And Bob said, well, you know, there's going to be problems with the budget because of the war and the Great Society pressures. You also should coordinate economic policy. So he said, I'll talk to the president. And Bob called me in that night and said, you're on board. The president, you'll also coordinate economic policy. You got to remember now, I wasn't even 34 years old. I was about to be 34 years old. And then I was invited over to a dinner at the White House in the White House mess that Johnson was having for people that were his outside advisors, like John Kenneth Galbraith, mm-hmm. and a group of economists and what have you. And I sat there, and he, you know, talked to them. And introduced me as a member of his staff. I still not talked to him. And then on the way out, I shook hands, and he said, I want you at the ranch. Come down to the ranch this weekend.
Yeah, and off you went.
And I got on a plane at 4 a.m.
Yes.
And ended up at the ranch, and that was it. And when I went to work for him, I think there's always luck. And then I think also the Watts riots. The riots in Watts occurred 2 weeks after I was there. And you have to think about this, especially in Kansas. Remember, Johnson flies out in the end of July 65 to sign the Medicare bill with Harry Truman and Bess Truman.
Out here in Independence.
The Truman Library,
yeah, right.
Out there in Independence. And he gives them the first cards. And he's on a terrific high, and then he flies back and to sign the Voting Rights Act, which he signs at the Capitol, and to just incredible cheers. And then he gets on a plane the next day, fly out to the ranch to take it easy. And that night, a guy drove into a liquor store and was arrested by the cops, a black arrested by a white cop. And there was a little disturbance. Nobody paid any attention to it. The next night, 5,000 people rioted in Watts. There were deaths, there were killing. And he went into the president went into a real depression. He had these enormous mood swings,
mm-hmm.
highs and lows. And I'm alone in the White House and handling this. And I call him, and he doesn't call me back. The only time he never called me back in any call I ever made to him. And then, you know, I'm getting pressure from the people in California and the lieutenant governor who was there, Anderson. Yorty, who was the mayor of Los Angeles, mm-hmm. saying this is what happens when you tell people they're going to have all kinds of things from the government attacking Johnson. Next day, more riots. The Army wants the National Guard and the governor want help from the Army to fly more guardsmen to Watts. Call the president, doesn't call me back. 2.5 days. And I finally okayed them delivering guardsmen and tear gas and equipment, the regular army. And Jack Valenti notified the president that I did that. He was down at the ranch with him. And then he called me back. And so, but it worked well. I did the right things, and he really, really was depressed for those 2 or 3 days.
Wow, you know, you tell
us.
Go ahead, Joe.
No, you go ahead.
Well, you tell a story that precedes this just by a little bit. 1963, Cyrus Vance, who would go on to be Secretary of State under Jimmy Carter, you already mentioned him. He's Secretary of the Army. Again, very influential in your career. He had an assignment for you. This was very much in the aftermath of a Kennedy assassination. It involved you going over to Arlington Cemetery a day or two after the president was shot and killed, and you met Bobby Kennedy there. Tell us about that day and what your assignment was and what it was like to be at that place at that time.
Well, you know, I had come, I was, in addition to being general counsel of the Army, I was in charge of the civil works programs, the Corps of Engineers, and Arlington Cemetery. And I was in a dam in West Virginia when Kennedy was shot, and I flew back immediately, went into Cy Vance's office, and essentially said, you know, I came down here, I think it's over, and I'm going to get out of the government. And so I said, no, just wait. Just wait. You don't know Lyndon Johnson. Things are going to happen. He's an extraordinary person. And he said, in any case, I have something for you to do right away. The Attorney General wants to pick a place for the burial over in Arlington Cemetery. You're to meet him tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. And I went over there.
At the cemetery.
Pouring, yeah. At Arlington Cemetery. It was pouring rain. Bobby Kennedy was a shadow of himself. And we walked around that hill below the Lee Mansion, which I marked off the 3.2 acres that ultimately became the place where John Kennedy's grave would be. And Bobby Kennedy, I never, just so broken, so broken. A shadow of the strength, the strong Bobby Kennedy we all know. And he left, and I went back to the Pentagon. And then McNamara said to me, I want to make sure we own that land. I said, it's in the middle of Arlington Cemetery. So he said, I want a title search made. I said, it's in the middle of Arlington. He said, no, make a title search. So we did. Even we had to open up the Alexandria Courthouse in Virginia, did a title search, and then I signed a paper saying that, had a paper to approve setting that land aside forever for the Kennedy grave.
Mm-hmm.
The Secretary of Defense had no role in that legally, but he wanted to do something. So I put a line in where he could approve what the Secretary of the Army did. I signed the opinion. Cy Vance signed it. And I went over to get Bob McNamara to sign, and he was in his car looking at the site. So I drove over there, and he was trying to make sure it was right in the center of that hill as you came over the Lincoln Memorial Bridge. And he signed the order. And he said, you stay around now. We're going to need people like you more than ever.
Mm.
So
it changed your life. Yeah.
It changed my life.
Yeah. You know, you were 34 years old, Joe. You've already noted that. What was it like being 34 years old and advising the president of the United States? That's such an extraordinary thing.
Well, it was. I mean, it all happened very fast. I mean, I also, you know, McNamara said to me once that was done, he said, you finish up, it was a Wednesday when it was all nailed down, he said, finish up your work here Friday and get out of here and take a week off. I told the president I couldn't let you go until a week from Monday, but if you'll never get a week off with him. And in 3.5 years off, when I look back on it, I don't know how I did it. The adrenaline was enormous. Look, it was overwhelming. He was so different. You know, this is this Texan, this sort of big-eared, real Texan, with, thank God, a very good sense of humor. And I've been brought up in Brooklyn, and then we'd have these wonderful exchanges. You know, he'd say, I go out every year in the early fall, like September, around, talk to the best people we could find in New Orleans or San Francisco or New York or Boston or North Carolina, what have you. And he'd say, I want you to get out and learn something, find out about water, what's going on with water. I said, I know enough about water policy. He said, you don't know a damn thing about water. You come from Brooklyn. You think it comes out of a faucet and you think electricity comes out of a switch. and so I did go out and I did learn quite a bit about water, and it resulted in several changes we made in the law. He gave me some sensitive things to do at the beginning, and they worked, and I think that's what really locked it up for me. One was Watts.
Yeah.
One was when he wanted to take all the civil rights authority to himself and took the vice president out of all the civil rights stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think he did that because he didn't think Humphrey was tough enough in a really tough sense. And yeah. Johnson could be tough.
Joe, I've got a minute left. Is the nation in the process of reconsidering Lyndon Johnson's legacy or not?
I think the nation is beginning that process. I think there is a recognition that we are living in his America, and the question is why and how. And I think if you look at the kinds of things that Hillary Clinton said in her speech yesterday, the kinds of things most of the Republicans are not attacking. There's no assault anymore on Medicare. Remember people saying, keep your hands off my Medicare.
Yeah.
You know, have a separate Affordable Care Act.
Joe, I'm going to have to scoot here. I got to wrap up. Yeah. I just want to point out that, again, Joe Califano's book, The Triumph and Tragedy of Lyndon Johnson. He'll speak at 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. Joe, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Well, same here. I enjoyed it. It was terrific. Thank you.
All the best, Joe.